don't you tell me about your passage from Russia to here on the ship when you arrived?
Well, we arrived in Ellis Island, and my sisters and brothers waited for us there. And they prepared an apartment for us. Two of my brothers were not married, so they undertook to rent the house. And it was a big thing, five rooms and a bathroom and a yard with flowers. It was a great thing, and that was in Brown's room. And there, my sister had a candy store, one of the sisters, and our house was not far from there. And I started to go to school, beginning with 1A.
What year was this and how old?
1913. Mm-hmm. June of 1913 is when I came in. And I guess school started in the fall, something, September, something like that. So I started to go to public school. And I guess I was going to school probably close to a year. But it was not an easy time to go to school. My mother soon, she was a very independent woman. She soon got herself a little restaurant. And before she did that, she remarried. She remarried a man a couple of years younger than she was and opened a restaurant. And the thing that she had her asset was that she has a daughter that's going to work in the restaurant. But I didn't like the whole idea, so I went to school and I stayed with a sister. And that didn't last very long because my family all needed some help. So when I got settled in the school, when one sister got sick, I dropped school and went to the sister to take care of her. And that was, one lived in Brownsville and one lived in Connecticut. So when I got settled in Connecticut, my sister in Connecticut thought that she won't let me go back to New York, to Brooklyn, because I looked half-starved and not dressed well. So she got the idea, and I got settled there in the sixth grade. The only trouble was that when I started in the first day, naturally I went up, because I was not a little girl, so I went up to the fifth grade, when I was due to the sixth grade. In Brooklyn, it was 6A was like 6B, because there they had a different system, and it was very difficult to get in without knowing the language, to get into to the higher grade. And just as I got comfortably settled, the sister in Brooklyn got sick, and I dropped everything and went to her. And that's when my education finished, my public school education finished. Well, then I worked in my sister's place. She had a little child. That's the reason I went back, because it was the time of the polio that came in, infantile paralysis it was called. And children there were just dying like the flies. So I took that child and went to the other sister in Connecticut to prevent her from it. But when we arrived there, she had fever and they wouldn't let her in. So I was under quarantine on an attic for 2 weeks with her until it was known that she didn't have polio. When I came back to New York, I had a third sister that was in great trouble. Because the man that she met and got together with was a victim of the First World War. He came here. I guess I can get into this a little bit now. When he came here, it was with the idea of buying a cooperative farm for 12 families that was supposed to come from Russia. And my sister was part of that. She was pregnant with her first child, and the war broke out. All this went to nothing. All the people on the other side that were supposed to come here were taken to the war. And I started to to work in a waste factory in Brownsville. A friend took me up to get me started, and they paid me $1 a week. But they were not interested that I should sit for $1 a week and learn the trade. They were sending me errands. So I went one wiser on them. When they sent me errands, I went to my sister and washed all the floors and all the clothes. And 6 o'clock I arrived. Till they stopped sending me for errands. And then I learned how to sew buttons. When I learned how to sew buttons on waists, I went to New York for a job and got $5 a week instead of $1.
What kind of a place did you work in when you were in New York?
In New York, dresses. Mm-hmm. It was, again, finisher by dresses. Mm-hmm. It was in Local 22, and it was not a union shop then. Mm-hmm. But while I was there, there was a general strike, and they took the shop down, and that was the first time that I worked in a union shop. And that went up from $5 a week to $8 a week after it was organized.
Large shop was it?
There must have been about 25 to 30 people working there, including operators and pressers and all, about 30 or 35 people.
What different words? Men, women, skilled, unskilled?
Well, I guess everybody was skilled, with the exception of people like myself. They take up beginners. You don't have to know very much. I knew how to hold a needle because I worked a couple of weeks in the other place. But $5 was a lot of money in comparison to the $1. If I had gone up there first, it would be $1 a week there. Then you can't come up to $5 so quick. But I went in as an experienced finisher because I already knew how to hold a needle. So I told them that I'm experienced. But after the shop was organized, then the minimum wage was $8 a week for a finisher.
What were the conditions like before the strike occurred?
Before the strike, there was no wages and no hours. Mm-hmm. And people were exploited. Of course, I wouldn't know much before I came in. I was there about 3-4 weeks when the shop was taken down on a strike. There was a woman working in back of me. She was filling the dresses. What they call it? Forgot what they call it. It has a special name, I suppose it will come to me. And then there were operators, finishers, pressers, all kinds. It must have been, I couldn't remember, I think it's probably about 35 or 40 people in the shop. And the conditions in general was the sweatshops that time. Mm-hmm. And that's why in those years there was a lot of tuberculosis. Because people were working from dark to dark, never saw the sunshine, and most workers never knew their children. Because it wasn't enough that they were working long hours in the shop, but they used to take homework too. So the whole family could help. It was exploitation or something terrible. When the farm workers talked to me, why am I interested in helping the farm workers? I tell them that I remember the sweatshops, how it was.
How was the work divided between the men and the women within the shop?
There were finishers. There were always young women finishers. The pressers were men, and operators. For all the years that I remember, there were women operators and men operators, but the women never got the same wages.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember how much of a differential there was?
Well, I can't remember because I really didn't take much part. I was a green girl, didn't know the language, didn't know too much about the entire setup. I was about 15 years old.
And what language were you speaking?
I speak Yiddish and Russian. Mm-hmm. But I went to school a year. Whatever I learned in English, I used it.
From where were the people that you worked with? What ethnic were they?
Mostly Eastern European at that time. And I remember in another shop, and probably a year later, or maybe 2 years later, I worked in a shop with about 80 or 90 people, and there were about 30 finishers at the table. And my best friend was a black girl, a Negro girl, and she did not come from the same areas that Negroes are here. She came from the Southern Islands someplace. She was the daughter of a rich rancholder, whatever they had there, South America. And she came here to study. And her father died while she was here, so she didn't have any support, so she went to work. And this girl did such beautiful work, because she in the education in those years, people got the stitchery, you know, embroidery and crocheting, especially embroidery. And she was the finest person. And I recognized she spoke only English, and I knew enough English to get along, because that was already my second year in this country. And I remember the work she did, and she took me to her house once, and I was so deeply impressed with the fine work around her, everything handmade and clean, and the white collars and cuffs and white clothes and all that. My first introduction to a black person was a very dear friend that I made with her. And that's when we started to get the $8.50 was the union wage. But there was also piece work, and the fast workers were making more because they were rushing. Well, they had to really work hard, and nobody knew how much work they took at home. But when the union started to organize, they were pretty watchful of those things. And I know, but I don't remember exactly how much time it passed. But when I looked for a job, anything that was needed, I would go up and say I'm experienced, even if I wasn't. And I'd work a half a day to see I'm not experienced, but in the next job, in the same line, I already knew a little. So that's sometimes until I learned the work, I would go and collect 10 or 12 half days pay. But that's the way you had to do if you were on your own and you didn't have a lift from anybody. And hardly anybody had. There were so many immigrants there. And we knew how to struggle without getting any help from older people or relatives or anything like that.
With all the ethnic differences in the shop that you worked in, was it hard to communicate with different languages?
Well, everybody used English.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody had some English, good or bad, but they had English. One very smart little American girl that knew a little bit Yiddish knew how to play a joke on me, so I imagine she played on others. She says, how do you say in English, in Yiddish, I'm a bad fool, you're a big fool, or I'm a big fool, I don't know. And I was showing off that I can say it in English, so she told me, I'm a big fool, something. I don't remember exactly the joke, but this is the way American Jewish girls knew a little bit in Jewish, you know. But anyway, I think that time they're mostly from Eastern Europe, from South America, from Italy, mm-hmm. from Germany, from Russia, Poland, this the kind.
Was the work divided among the different ethnic groups? Were different people doing different work?
Well, we were all treated like cattle at that time.
This is before the strike, I mean, also after.
In that particular time, there wasn't any that I could tell. It was mostly the same kind of people.
Mm-hmm.
We were all victims of the same environment.
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't know anymore, because I was too young to be able to observe all the others. But I knew how the system worked. There was exploitation within the exploitation. For instance, somebody that was a labor leader in later years that I knew him in the last years of his life, was a presser. And a presser would take other pressers And he would collect the sort of, we work communally. He would collect all the wages and give them, so give the other workers so much, and he would keep the. You see, like a exploitation within the exploitation. It all worked. It was supposed to be peace work. So he evaluated that. Well, if somebody came up to learn, somebody green that just came from Europe, well, it takes a couple of weeks to learn, but when they begin to produce the same as he does, they're entitled to get the full value of their production. But this is what happened. They were fooled out right by the workers.
What were the sanitary conditions before the strike? Did they change from before to after?
Not too much. There were separate for ladies and men's rooms, but they were not very clean. Mm-hmm. And there was no air conditioning. When it was hot, it was hot. When it was cold, it was cold. So not very, very good. But the well organized shops, the bigger shops, were different than the little shops. Mm-hmm. And I did not stay very long because I took the children home and became a mother.
Yes. When you were still there, were the what year was the strike, and how old were you during the strike?
Now,
this is local 22.
I must have been 1916.
Mm-hmm.
I think about 1916. It would be easy to trace the time.
Yeah.
But I think it must have been, I'm feeling at the time when I was 16 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I gave up school, but I never gave up education. And you get an early training when you're in Russia. There are no schools for Jewish children unless you can pay and bribe a teacher, even if you're entitled to it, to a small percentage. So we are used to learn from each other. All Russia at that time was educated that way. When anybody learned the ABC, he was teaching the next one. And so I, in Russia, a high school girl that finished high school came back home. I was going to have a lesson. I think we talked about it last time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did not stop here. When I was working in the shop, there was a lectures in Cooper Union in New York, and Professor, the historian now, what's his name? I'll have to put it in later. I can't remember his name. The historian and his wife that wrote this, Professor Durant. He was the first teacher of the school where I had my children. I couldn't remember his name. Professor Durant was giving lectures in the Cooper Union. So I remember sitting in the shop, and the girls, all Wednesday night was the going out night on dates. And they were all talking about going out on their dates. And I was going to Cooper Union. And I had a book writing down all the words. And for the rest of the week, I studied with a Russian-English dictionary, the language. And so Mrs. Durant that time was, she was probably at the time 18 when I was 15. And she was a very foolish, very stupid girl. He really erased her. He married, she was one of the pupils, of his pupils. He raised her, and she would get up and ask questions. But anyway, that's what I was interested more than anything, was the language. And so I would, and that's, I had books written full of English words with translations from the Russian dictionary. And then when I was out of the shop, when I took the children home, I would sit all day in the park with them and study. And once a week I would get a lesson from a tutor to learn the English language.
What I wanted you to tell me about was when the strike occurred, back when you were still in the shop, and how it was that, who led the strike?
There is Antonini, who is a retired in the Dressmakers Union in New York. He's retired now as an Italian fellow. He was a young, handsome fellow. He was planted there as a presser,
mm-hmm.
and he was the organizer in the shop.
Mm-hmm.
So he stayed and worked there before it was taken down from the to the strike. He came in with that purpose, and he was the organizer. And next to him, the girl that worked in back of me was the draper. She was draping the dresses, mm-hmm. fitting them on the form, you know. And she was a woman much older than I am, but I was a child at 15. She was a woman, and she was supporting the strike. Otherwise, the girls, I can't remember, didn't make any impression. But when they were taken down, everybody was taken down. The union did a good job in organizing, and our wages came up from $5 to $8.50 a week for all the week workers. And as I remember, one of the things, it may have been later, in later years, because the unions were not organized at just one time. They abolished some of the week work, the piece work, mm-hmm. And put on the week workers so that they shouldn't rush so much to put out so much work.
What were some of the complaints when you went on strike? Was it the take home work and
the conditions? There were no hours conditions. So they would keep you working all hours. The 48 hours was one of it. Mm-hmm. And the conditions in the shop were not sanitary. The breaks that people were entitled to, not like not as many as now, but the hour should have been kept, the hour lunchtime should for that, because people were working all the time on the piecework. People wanted to make more money, so they worked on the lunch hour, and they worked after hours, overtime and undertime and day and night, you know. And this was the conditions.
How were the complaints drawn up? Was there a general meeting of the workers?
Oh, yes. I remember we were taken down to the union mm-hmm. To be organized, and there were many meetings before the strike was finished. The buses didn't give in many meetings, taking a seat. And the way they did at the time, they didn't take down all the shops at once. They took down mm-hmm. one by one. For instance, when they declared the strike, there were some of the big shops with a lot of some of them had hundreds of people in their shops. These people, some of these were the first ones, you know, you attack that first. The smaller ones were taken later, one by one. Now, I don't know very much about that particular time in my life. I didn't know too much about how it was done. But I know that we were all taken in to the union, to the union halls. And also picketing, things like that. Oh, sure.
How long were you picketing before your demands were met?
By the time this small shop that I was working in, the boss claimed to be a socialist. Mm-hmm. He said he was a socialist. By the time they got to this small shop, the big shops were already unionized. Mm-hmm. And then a lot depended on the people. You had to watch that the people should not cheat on time. Mm-hmm. You still do right here, right now. You still do. You still have to watch people cheating on the time.
When you went out on strike, did the whole shop go on strike?
Oh yes.
Who was organizing it from above? Was it when you formed the local 22?
The local we were part of the local 22. There were many shops, mm-hmm. but this Antonini later became our vice president there mm-hmm. for many years. He was our organizer. Mm-hmm. He organized and he worked in the shop and kept the conditions.
So your strike wasn't a wildcat strike. It had the support of the government.
Not a wildcat. The government. This was a general organization period, like they're having now, for instance, we practice our orchestra in the union, mm-hmm. and now it used to be mostly Jewish people and Russians from Eastern European. Now it's mostly Mexican people in the trade, and it's a very tragic thing because the bosses lure the illegal scene. And the union comes in and organizes them, and when they go down, a certain paper last week, the bosses tell the police that these are illegal aliens, and the police comes and arrest them, and then they get other illegal aliens for scabs, It's a very tragic thing that's happening now.
Were most of the leaders of your strike Jewish? Were they Jewish enemies?
No. No, the Antonini, they had a Jewish local, they had an Italian local.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the other about any others, but a special Italian local.
Was the local you were in, which?
In the 22 had the vote. It wasn't just all in one, but it had a section.
Mm-hmm.
It was an Italian organizer, and there were many others, whatever ethnic groups they had. But in that period, they were mostly Eastern Europeans.
Mm-hmm. When the speeches were given to organize the workers, were they given in several different languages?
Yes, if it the shop that I was in was mixed people, and it was in English, and there were Italian workers, there was an Italian talker. Any other languages, I guess there would be others.
Did a Jewish immigrant come in and speak Yiddish with you?
Not with me, because I was speaking English. You know, I had a year schooling, you know.
Well, you, the collective you, in the shop.
The ones that they have to speak too much are those that are the people that are inclined not to go there.
Mm-hmm.
But then they take us into the union. They speak in, for instance, if they see there are half and half, or there are some people that don't understand the language, they would have somebody speaking that language.
Mm-hmm.
But there is an Italian local even today, I think, in New York.
When the strike was successful, did the union stay as organized as it was during the strike?
Yes, they had somebody inside working to keep it together.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things was that you had elected a union chairman,
mm-hmm.
and anybody that came up to work, he had to have a union card. The chairman would send him to the union to get a card.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, he couldn't work without a card. Oh yes, that's how the union has developed.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't do otherwise, because they turn around and they just deunionize it. And the workers themselves, they don't keep the... And right now they are watching all the time shops that they're organizing, who is working when they're not supposed to. And the chairman or the chairlady in the dresses and in the blouses, there were a lot of mostly women. And there were women chair ladies,
mm-hmm.
women taking care of price committees. All this was, it was developed within the years of unionizing.
How many years were you in the Ladies' Garment Union?
Not very long, because when I was 18, I got the children home.
So it was from about when you were 14?
About 14, yeah.
What kind of women do you remember as partaking in the leadership?
Oh, at that time there were so many great women like Elizabeth Gurley Freen, and I can't remember all the names, but I'll make it my business to remember them, write them down for you.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of women.
Mm-hmm.
Elizabeth Gurley Freen was an IWW,
mm-hmm.
and of course Emma Goldman, and Rebecca, I forgot her name. Edelstein or something. There were a lot of women in the leadership at that time.
Were there women in the leadership of the Ladies' Garment Union itself?
Oh, yes. Yes,
but
there were. Oh, I can. That's easy. That's written down. There's plenty of books, I guess, in my house, too. That's easy to find out.
Well, how do you remember them? When you think of the leadership...
Well, I cannot remember. I don't forget. I was just a mere child when I was working in the shop, and most of my life I did not work in the shop. I became a mother. That was my to keep my children in good health was the main thing. But
how did you feel about going on strike when you all went on strike? You feel
great.
Like, was there
sure.
The unity among the workers? There weren't people scabbing?
It all depends.